Welcome to Identity, a series brought to you by ID Magazine. Join me, Osman Ahmed, ID's Fashion Features Director, as I explore the enduring legacy of some of the last four decades' most influential subcultures and the guiding figures within them. This season, we're taking a different tack, with each episode focusing on an artist whose life and work are anchored in subculture. Today, I'm joined by London nightlife legend and former Boombox host, James Jeanette May.
Being different wasn't celebrated. It was feared. I wanted glamour. Looking back now, actually, it was subversive. Something about the sound of those heels clacking down on the pavement. It was like, look at me. I could feel like there was something repressive about society, and I wanted to break through that with sound. We were partying so much. It was like a dream or something. It did feel glamorous, but it was like really trashy. But it wasn't about labels or blah, blah, blah for the kids. They were all like making stuff out of nothing. You know, it was about expressing yourself with whatever you have.
Having grown up in the self-described grey suburbs as a teenager, James began exploring Aberdeen's queer scene, eventually finding his way to London, where he became a hairdresser, coiffing the likes of Grace Jones, and also cutting a sharp figure on the nightlife scene. In the mid-2000s, he became the so-called door girl for Richard Mortimer's Sunday evening club night, Boombox. It was there that he was known under the moniker of Jeanette. The club night marked a renaissance in queer London nightlife. As one of the handful of nightlife venues in the East End, it marked a shift in the city's creative centre, playing host to fashion designers, musicians, artists, art students, and indeed the occasional icon who passed through Jeanette on their way into the dance floor. Boombox closed its doors on New Year's Eve in 2007. Just before the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the subsequent recession decimated life for artists and creatives living in central London. A time before social media, photographs by the Club Night's photographer Alistair Allen have been immortalised for future generations. And the queer nightlife scene in the East End has only slowly dissipated since. After Boombox in 2009, James opened Jeanette's, a tiny former garage off Red Church Street in Shoreditch, where he sold one-off exclusives from the likes of his friends Christopher Kane, Louise Gray, Richard Nickel, Noki and Judy Blaine. At the time, Time Out magazine described it as the East End's most avant-garde boutique. Music soon came calling, and in 2014, he formed Wild Daughter with Stuart McKenzie, a self-proclaimed garage kink band, borrowing the codes of 70s rock and roll, punk and S&M. In 2020, James moved to Berlin, where he has been making music since. Here he is, James Jeanette Main. Hello, James. I'm excited to be speaking to you. Thank you so much for being part of this. I have a lot of questions for you, but I wanted to start with the obvious. Some people know you as James, other people know you as Jeanette. Can you tell us a bit about where those names came from, what you prefer to be known by?
It's interesting that this is a podcast for ID and it's about identity. And for me, I guess my growth in this human experience, as well as how I work in my art, is playing with different aspects of identity. And for me, that has been evolving. And I'm still very much the same soul I always was. How I present myself is in flux. And I guess from different moments in my life, I've taken on a different side of my soul, or let's say personality or identity, has been more on show, let's say. And so I guess for me, it's been very fluid, but in a very unconscious way.
So James, let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell me a bit about where you grew up and what your upbringing was like and your first memory of expressing your identity when you were young?
I grew up in Aberdeen. Well, actually, it was a small village outside Aberdeen. And I learned from a young age that the way I wanted to express myself at that time, because it was a different time than we're living in now, being different wasn't celebrated. It was feared. So my first memory of being a little soul in this world, in this human experience, the way I wanted to express myself, I wanted glamour in this tiny little grey village. And at the time I was 4 years old, and I was watching Dynasty on TV. Looking back now, actually, it was subversive, because I was obsessed with Alexis, John Collins's character. I wanted to be this rich bitch in this little grey village, which actually was a subversive act. And I'd run around the streets in my mother's clothes. And it was something about, it wasn't just the clothes, it was something about the sound of those heels clacking down on the pavement. It was like, look at me. I could feel like there was something repressive about society, and I wanted to break through that with sound, actually, with this, you know, click-clacking. It was really about the sound of the heels on the pavement. That was really a powerful tool for me. But I learned very quickly that this wasn't cool at that time in this place. And I don't want to say anything now about how the people, you know, I got a bit later when I was at school and stuff, I got bullied and stuff. But, you know, it was a different time. And we've moved on so much now. And it's just fear, you know, people are just fear. And it's more about actually the wider society. It's not the individual people, I would say. You know, I don't want to be like, oh, it was so terrible. I mean, it was awful, because on a personal level, it takes years to unpick a lot of this. I think there's a lot of trauma in people who are told from a young age that they're wrong. Because really at that young age, you just want to feel safe, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, one of the things about growing up and realizing that you're different is that, you know, you think that everyone must be different. You feel like other people must feel this way. And ultimately, what you crave is a sense of belonging. And if you're ostracized within your community that you grew up in, you desperately want to find your tribe. I think that's such a human thing. It's such a big theme of this podcast, identity, and everything that we've kind of explored in terms of subcultures.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely.
So when was that moment for you when you realized that you had to go farther afield and find your people, your tribe?
I think I knew that from even as that little child. So that was it's an exploration, isn't it? It's like, who are my people then? And you would have, you know, different, even in childhood, it's like this, gosh, it's a lot, isn't it? It's a preparation for the rest of your life in a way. So yeah, I guess, you know, when I was a teenager, you know, I had different moments. I was like hanging out with like the skater boys for a bit and this group and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, but it wasn't until I kind of ventured out into clubland in Aberdeen, and I was hanging out with people much, much older than me. And it was a really, there was a cool, groovy crowd actually at that time. And it was like the early 90s, and it was the time of house music, you know, ecstasy and that whole scene. And there was one particular club that was called Joy, and it was run by these old soul boys, and the music was really brilliant. And it was, you know, that was the beginning of another world. But then, you know, I realized after a few years, I knew I had to get out of that town. And, you know, tragically, some people who were, there was these amazing queens I met at that point, much older than me, amazing characters, are really like, you know, products of their time, hard queens. And a few of them died, you know, and I knew I had to get out of that town. And at the time, actually, I was reading magazines like ID and And I could see, you know, there was another world in London. You know, I was like 15 or 16 at this point, and I just knew I had to get there. And there was another world waiting for me there. And my people were there.
Okay, and so you did get to London.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. What was it that pulled you into to King's Cross or wherever it was? And what happened when you arrived in the city?
Well, me and a friend of mine, we ran away together and we lived in Kilburn. And, you know, we were going out in, you know, it was like the late 90s. You know, it was fun. It was an amazing time. You know, there was somewhere brilliant to go every night. Yeah, I quickly met a whole bunch of people. You know, London's brilliant. You can really meet people really quick. I mean, it's hard. I think it is hard for a lot of people when you first move to London. But you can quickly find your tribe, you know, in clubs or whatever it is. I mean, I'm not living in London anymore. So I do, you know, like you feel when you're away from somewhere, you really see it with different eyes. I love London. I feel like I'm, you know, I am a Londoner. I'm a Scottish person, but I'm a Londoner, you know, I'm definitely. And it's a friendly city. I really think it's such a friendly city. And there's like this connection of people. There is a community in London that's, you know, the elders and people who've been around and this passed on kind of thing and this kind of the new kids coming up and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's a, yeah, it's very special.
And tell me about where you were going out, who you were hanging out with, what it was like at that time, how you were expressing yourself, what were you wearing? Take us back to London at that moment for you.
Yeah, it was the late 90s when I got to London. As I say, I was already hanging out with like this really older, cool crowd in Aberdeen. So I kind of thought I kind of knew it all already, you know, so I wasn't, but you know, but London's a whole other thing. But I had this attitude that, you know, I was kind of, so I came with my thing already. And then, you know, I was going out and yeah, it was this time of like, you know, it was like something like a new club opening every week. And it was also this time of like, you know, you could be somewhere out and it'd be like funny mixtures of like celebrities, but with like whatever, you know, it was very kind of still quite a wild time. Yeah. And then I guess for me, you know, it takes, you know, a few years, you're like a kid and you're just rolling around. And then it kind of, it was all around like West London and Soho. And then there's like, and then, you know, discovered like East London, you know, we all moved there and it was like, you'd be out all the time. Yeah, you know, all just kind of blends, doesn't it? It's like the years just blend. And then, you know, it was the Electro Clash kind of time, it was the early 2000s. And that really felt like a movement. You know, it was a time, you know, everyone could just start a band. People were just doing, making their own music. You know, it was, well, it's come out of this time in the 90s where, you know, it was more like, I guess, what the punk scene would have been like. And that was, that was brilliant. And there was like brilliant parties every night.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I actually grew up in East London and I really remember that time because I remember how much it was changing. And, you know, you, it was incredibly gritty, but you did have this kind of incredible creative scene that was blossoming there in the Truman Brewery where lots of artists and designers were based. And, you know, there were offices for independent magazines. Yeah. I remember thinking that there was a massive shift going on from West London to East London. A lot of people were moving there. And this something was percolating in the air. One of the places that I think it was really shifting was in nightlife.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which obviously you know a lot about. So tell me a bit about what was going on and what was happening at night in Shoreditch. Who was coming to party there?
It'd been going on already, you know. But then I think the more, let's say, queer aspect of the Shoreditch, East London nightlife, that became a movement in itself around 2003. And we were all part of that. It was the Georgian Dragon, went to the Joiner, you know, it's just, and it was just that strip and it was just carnage. You know, historically, there's always been this kind of queer connection around there and all these kind of, you know, the first Stunners was on Kings End Road. Remember, we discovered that and you had to knock in the door. And there was a guy with like, you know, a rubber apron in there, you know, it was like wild. It was like, you know, taxi drivers and they're like, you know, was having sex It was a trans sex club, you know, it was brilliant. It was fantastic. With all these kind of hidden, secret, sordid places and these, it was, yeah.
So tell me a bit about who you were hanging out with. Who were some of the key figures on the scene?
I remember when Johnny Wu came back from New York, he'd been living in New York, and he turned up at the Georgian Dragon, and he was DJing, and then we became friends very quickly. And we started doing this night called Radio Egypt in this old church down Hackney Road. I think Johnny as a force kind of pooled all of us together in that aspect. We were doing performances and stuff as well as, you know, it was a party, but there was like a performance aspect to it. And then, you know, obviously it's like Princess Julia and everyone, you know, and all the, everyone was around that whole time. And then a bit later, well, Richard was a friend of mine. We were working together in this hair salon, and he was the one who started the club Boombox, which I ended up hosting. And so everyone was doing different nights here and there, you know. There was like, yeah, I mean, it's hard to even kind of remember. There was literally so many parties going on. But there was like, you know, Jim and that doing the cock in on the ghetto on a Friday night and Nag 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 and all that as well. There was just so much, you know, and it was, every night was different as well. So it was really brilliant.
Yeah, we're going to come to Boombox shortly, but I'm curious to know what you think set London nightlife apart from anywhere else in the world at this time.
Oh, I don't know. That's hard to answer. I mean, I did go to New York in the early 2000s, and that had a similar vibe at that time as well, actually, you know, this kind of like trashy element that was going on there as well, you know, Williamsburg, and it did feel glamorous, but it was like really trashy. It was kind of like, you know, I'd always been like looking back, you know, into the kind of Warhol superstars. It had that element about it, this early 2000 time, I think. It was just this kind of like, you know, you've done too much drugs and you're just kind of a mess. But it's still glamorous. You know, it was that kind of vibe, was just the zeitgeist at the time. So, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't just London. But London particularly has this kind of humor about it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. I think that's really beautiful about London. It's very special. You know what I mean?
So you mentioned Boombox, which I think is a huge part of your story and what so many people know you for. How did you get involved with it? And what was it? Tell us about it.
It doesn't seem that long ago, but it also feels like another lifetime to me as well. You know, I've kind of, so much has happened since then. And as I say, we were partying so much that it kind of, you know, I can't remember that much, but I, you know, it does feel something like it was like a dream or something, but it's, you know, so yeah, Richard and me were working in this hair salon together. We were, that was our day jobs in Chelsea. It's very like upmarket salon. It was really fabulous. Like Isabella Blow and people like that used to go there. It was really fantastic.
Wait, on the subject of this, do you remember reading that you did Grace Jones's hair? Is that true?
I did at that time with that from that salon. Philip Tracy used to come to the salon. All these people were going there. So through Philip, I met Grace, and I ended up doing her hair for a while. But yeah, so that was our day jobs, and then we were all living in East Shoreditch at that time, and then he started a night with Danilo, who was a friend of ours. Then it changed the night and it became Boombox. And then he'd asked me to just host and do the door. And it kind of then shifted from, you know, this kind of really trashy thing to then, I think Richard was trying to make it something. It was still trashy, but it was trying to lift it a bit more to something else, I guess. It was this old idea of like, you had to make an effort, and that was the whole part. It was a performance that as well. You know, the whole thing of like, you know, it's funny now. Every now and then people will be like, I'll meet someone, they'll be like, oh, you never let me into the club or whatever. And I was like, really? Because in my mind, I was letting everyone in, because it wasn't really a bitchy kind of thing. It was more just like, it was like a bit of a performance. Because those kids who were coming at that time were really making an effort. So it was to try and like, I mean, most of the time, if I didn't let someone in, it was because the club was actually full. You know, it was like there was a capacity. It wasn't a huge venue, really. But, you know, some people were assholes and I just didn't let them. If you were nice, you'd get in. But, you know, these kids were really making effort. You'd see their faces and they were like, and a lot of them were like fashion students or art students. And but it felt like this was their moment. This was their time. And it was a really special time for them. So my part of it was just to play that part as well, you know, to make it kind of, that's where I see my part in the whole thing was just to try and keep it, it was entertainment, you know what I mean? Keep it like on this level of like, yeah, you have to up your game to come here kind of thing. But it wasn't about labels or blah, blah, blah for the kids. They were all like making stuff out of nothing. You know, it was about expressing yourself with whatever you have. So it was like that had shifted. I hadn't seen that. You know, I think that was a thing. Maybe it was like being in London way back, obviously the New Romantic time and stuff. Maybe it was, you know, that electroclashy thing was maybe more the punk kind of vibes. And this was kind of moving into what maybe that had been like in a different way, but that kind of same expression of like, let's dress up and make the most out of what we've got, you know?
I think what's so interesting for me is that Boombox follows in the footsteps of so many iconic London nightlife clubs, especially queer clubs. Think of Blitz and Taboo and, you know, Steve Stranger on the Door. But I also think what's really interesting about this time is it's when the internet is in its infancy and it's before social media. And, you know, something like Boombox was Instagram at the time. It's where you would go to see what people were wearing, to get your inspiration, to meet people, connect. You know, and there was this kind of gallery aspect to it because so many artists were involved and it had a performance element to it. You know, and I think that's why so many young people are interested in it today and interested in looking back to it.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, it's nice how you phrase that. And actually thinking about that further, because it wasn't really a late night club. You know, it was a Sunday night. I can't even remember. It kind of started early-ish and it finished early. So it was people would make this huge effort and, yeah, parade around and it was very performative and be on the bar and blah, 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 and whatever was going on that night as well. And then they would go off to these after parties and it would continue into something else or not, whatever. But it was more this, it was this very, yeah, performative thing. But not in, as you say, it was before social media and all that. So it was just for each other. It wasn't to be like, you know, documenting it on your page or whatever.
So take us back there. What was it like being at Boombox? What did it look like inside? What was the music? What does it smell like?
Oh, God. Well, I was on the front. I was front. I'd be on there. And, you know, I was having my own little performance on the door. And people drank a lot in that club as well. It was really a place, you know, people, it was like, let's get hammered kind of thing. It was wild. And, you know, I'd work on the door and then I'd come in. And by that point, the party was like almost coming to an end. You know, it was really like in the middle of the whole, you know. So it was packed, sweaty, and drinks spilled everywhere and dresses ripped and just like, you know, people's makeup running down their face. You know, they'd come in all fabulous. And then by the end of it, it was all starting to fall apart.
Yeah, I just find it so interesting that at certain points that, you know, this kind of radical creativity rises to the surface. And there's just this basic human need to be really expressive and to experiment with how you present yourself to the world. I think it all just kind of bubbles up and explodes, which is what I imagine was happening at this time in Boombox. But for you, kind of zooming out and thinking about this time, and especially, you know, the mid-2000s, was there a sense that you were rebelling against something, or that this kind of scene was happening in response to something going on in the wider world?
It was the end of, coming up to the end of the 2000s. So, you know, like, let's say if the 90s were our 60s, the 2000s were our 70s. And it was coming to the end of that time, which was said it was, you know, it was very much partying and expressing yourself. And then things really changed, like 2008. I noticed a change in London after that, kind of the financial, supposed, you know, financial crash time. And I have a friend who's an astrologer, and astrologically as well, supposedly, you know, something shifted. Pluto went into Capricorn for 12 years. So, you know, everyone, it was more about work. Get your, you know, don't look. And then also social media and everything came in. And it was like, you had to look like you were together. You couldn't be a fabulous mess anymore. In public anyway, you know. So it was the last hurrah, perhaps. But, you know, the party still is going on somewhere. But it was a way of just being expressive of this on a Sunday night where you're, you know, you've got to go to work perhaps on Monday, but you don't care because you want to, like, make an outfit out of nothing and go out and get completely wasted and then crawl home and then, you know, who cares about tomorrow? But that was really the last felt like, you know, and obviously, like, London got way more expensive after that as well. And then much more competitive. So you have, you know, you've got to be more seemingly kind of together, I guess. Mm. I don't know.
Well, we haven't even talked about your looks, which are phenomenal, by the way. I mean, I'm thinking of kind of these leather cat suits, incredible hairdos, like amazing makeup. There's so many to describe. But I think it was New Year's Eve 2007 that Boombox closed its doors. And fashion has always been really important to you because soon after you then opened up your own boutique, Jeanette's, which had all of these kind of incredible London designers in it. And it, I think it was described by Time Out magazine as the most avant-garde boutique in London at the time. So what was behind that decision to become a shopkeeper and start selling all of these fabulous clothes?
It was just an extension, I guess, of, you know, we're going to the club and hanging out and all the group, my friends at the time, you know, these brilliant people who were, a lot of them just starting up, but also people like Judy Blame and, you know, so, yeah, it just felt like a natural thing to do. And there was a place to hang out as well. It was meant to be that as well.
And just for context for listeners, this is very much in the heart of Shoreditch, just off Church Street, which I don't know if you've been there recently, James, but there are no independent shops anymore. It's gotten very, very posh. And I feel like, you know, the shop that you had probably, well, definitely wouldn't exist today.
No, I mean, there was nothing then. Maybe like the year after my shop closed down and then like Soho House opened and then, you know, and then it was this like hotel and it was a place to hang out. But it was people who were hanging out were some of the designers who were, you know, their clothes were there and friends. And we'd have like little events and stuff. And people did come to buy. We had a lot of press and stuff. Remember Rick Owens and Michelle coming, you know, and on Saturday morning they turned up. And yeah, people were hearing about it. So people did come. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I remember seeing it in the pages of ID at the time.
Yeah.
But when did Jeanette's close and what came next? Because I know you then started making music and you started a band called Wild Daughter. When did that kind of happen and what was going on at that time for you?
Oh, well, now I'm going to get all personal. So I got pretty into quite a bad place. The drugs I was taking got a bit harder. Let's just say that. So I went to rehab. It wasn't a conventional rehab. I went to this temple in Thailand to get off this particular drug and detoxed and then, you know, worked on myself a bit. And then I came back to London and it was like, I'm going to start a band. So that's kind of how my life was going. It was like, now I'm going to do this. Now I'm going to, you know, obviously I've always loved music. Music is, you know, but it was just, this was the right time now. And yeah, I met with Stuart and we had similar ideas about what we wanted to do with a band. And yeah, that was it. That was the beginning.
And how would you describe the sound? I think you previously described it as garage kink. Is that right?
That was the kind of thing that we coined I think that explained the roots of it. And it obviously it changed a bit, but that was definitely the roots, garage kink.
And I know you're actually joining us from Berlin. Yeah. So when did you move there?
So I moved to Berlin end of 2019. I just had this really strong feeling. I would had a very good year with that band, with Wild Dora. But I just had this strong feeling I need to get out of London. Just this real feeling. It was more a personal thing, but it was just this. I always follow my intuition. I do have a very strong intuition. Well, I was moving actually the week that COVID hit. So anyway, let's not even go into all that because it's whatever. But you know, I got here in the middle of 2020. I moved to Berlin, so I've been here a few years, and it's a really brilliant city to work in music. There's a lot of fantastic musicians here. Like, you know, there's such a history for it. And I mean, there's a lot I miss about London and the people. You know, London, as we spoke about earlier, the people are fantastic. And Berlin, I've met some fantastic people, but it's different here. Sometimes it feels like it's a village, but it's a great place to work on new things, experiment. And that's what I wanted to do.
I'm interested to know, because at the start of our conversation, you described the sound of a pair of heels click-clacking across the pavement. I'm curious, you know, all of these experiences that you've had in your life and in London, but also elsewhere, how that informs your music, that idea of expression and identity. How does that come through in the work that you're making today?
Wow, that's a really beautiful question, actually, because it's actually where I'm at the moment, and I'm working on a beginning of a solo project, and I'm looking at my history, and particularly in Scotland. And I don't know how it's got to be informed, you know, but it's very much, it's funny, yeah, I guess it's, and in a wider aspect, this kind of, those click-clack, the heels were my first instrument. It was my first way of making a noise in the world and demanding my space. And sometimes you feel like you've got to fight for it. And I think a lot of my life I was fighting in a way. Now I'm just a bit more, you know what, I can just do my thing. And if it, like, you know, just put it out there and it doesn't matter. As long as it's for me, you know? And it's great if other people connect to that. It's really beautiful because, you know, essentially we are all connected. But yeah, that little child click-clacking down the street, it was for himself. He had to just do that, you know. And all the other stuff is just extra noise.
I love that. It feels like a full circle moment.
Yeah, full circle.
And I think that brings us to the end of our conversation, James. Thank you so much for being a part of this podcast. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you and to hear all about your journey.
Well, you, Osman.
This episode of Identity was presented by me, Osman Ahmed, with research by Ailey Duffy and art direction by Callum Glenday. The producer was Amelia Phillips, with audio production from Robin Lieberman and Simon Williams. Identity is a Podmouse's production for ID Magazine.